Concerns grow after 9 guns are found in Duval County schools. Protests outside the Duval County Courthouse opposing Donald Trump's immigration executive order. And finally, maybe some progress in renovating some downtown buildings. Some of the stories making headlines this week. Good Friday morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. And thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross. We are always live on the radio. Also, make sure to get our podcast through iTunes or listen through the WJCT app. Just ahead, all of the news of the week with our Friday roundtable. You can get on the line now. Call in at 549-2937. Then later, it's Go Red for Women, raising awareness of cardiovascular disease. And stick around, keep listening as we get a visit from Jacksonville's new all-female football team. That's right, the North Florida Pumas. All of that ahead. But first, it's Friday and time for the weekly roundtable as we welcome Claire Goforth, editor at Folio Weekly. Good morning.
Good morning.
David Bauerlein, veteran reporter for the Florida Times Union.
Good morning, Melissa.
Our own blogger and contributor, Fred Matthews.
Good morning, Melissa.
And WJCT business analyst, John Burr.
Hi, Melissa.
Thanks so much for being here, everybody. Lots to discuss this Friday, from that local protest against President Trump's immigration and travel ban to new investment for some downtown historic buildings. Could they finally get off the jump? We'll find out. But our top story this morning, parents and educators are concerned after reports that 9 guns have been found this school year in several different Duval County public schools. Superintendent Nicolai Vitti told parents this week that the students found with guns had no intention of using them on campus, that instead it's a sign of problems in their neighborhood and maybe their homes. But parents are speaking out and parent meetings are being held, particularly after several students and even a basketball coach were arrested on weapons charges at schools across the district. We begin the roundtable with a look at this. What are your thoughts about 9 guns being found on school campuses? It's 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online to wjctnews.org/firstcoastconnect. We want your emails, tweets, Facebook comments. David Bauerlein, let's begin with you. The Florida Times Union reported this story, and Superintendent Vitti trying to calm parents' fears, but clearly it's a matter of concern.
Well, I think as a parent of a son who goes to high school, one gun is one gun too many in schools, that's for sure. And, I understand where Vitti's coming from, but also we've had some cases where, thank goodness, relatively speaking, it didn't happen in school, but there have been in the last few weeks some shootouts, basically, in downtown and then in Arlington this week, in which, you read it and it's like teenagers who are the ones holding the guns. And, there's this sort of payback syndrome that is frightening. And you certainly don't want that combination of teenagers and guns in a school.
Sure. Volatile mix. And Fred Matthews, this isn't new for Duval County. I guess the recent high for the district was 10 guns found throughout the 2014-15 school year. Wasn't aware of that. But this isn't a new problem for the schools.
If anything, it's becoming a new normal, isn't it? Because this is where we are. In fact, if we look at the story of Times Union published, one of the parents that was interviewed when his young kid was found with a gun there had advised him to take the gun with you because his child had indicated he felt threatened at school. So the father gave him the gun and said, look, take it with you just in case. And in most of the cases that we see, that we've seen this week and probably in the past, it has been a question of the kids felt threatened, they got the gun, or they ticketed the school for training. I know several young men in my neighborhood, as a matter of fact, who've taken the guns from their parents so they could take it out in the street and trade it. literally,
wow.
For other things, for shoes, we won't talk about that. That's what they're doing.
That's what they're doing.
And basically, our legislature is saying these things are okay because what they're advocating open carry law, right? You'll be able to carry your gun on your hip. So what are we telling the kids?
Yeah, Claire.
Yeah, that's a very good point, Fred. When we always talk about these issues and we're looking at what has happened, I always think that this is part of a broader problem. We're looking at the economics that are the reality that lead kids into crime early ages and into the gang lifestyle. I mean, the glamorization of the gang lifestyle and this concept of just an invincibility that kids seem to have today about guns. I do think that it's very important that our schools are safe for kids, and if they're bringing guns, that is very worrisome. One bad incident, and you know, the community would mourn that, but I always think when we see children and the habits that they're picking up, we have to look at the broader forces at play and sort of start to answer the question about how do we improve the economic realities in some of these neighborhoods.
Sure. And, you know, John, as David Bauerlein pointed out, this comes on the heels of a couple of different fatal shooting incidents in downtown Jacksonville that police are investigating that they believe could be gang-related, and then they involve teenagers.
Right, and also the shooting in Arlington just the other day. You know, I think the superintendent really stepped in at this time. You can't reassure people by saying that the students had no intention of using guns on campus. I mean, you know, take Fred's example. The kid was given a gun by his father. He may have no intention to use the gun on campus. However, if he's confronted and he's got a gun in his pocket, you know, what's the logical next step? Or illogical, probably. I mean, you know, emotions take over in these situations, and what your intentions are can often go out the window.
All right. We'll assume that the incident in Baldwin with the high school teacher out there was alleged at this point. But the fact of the matter is that he is alleged, students alleged to have seen him show the gun to kids at school. And when they checked his car, he has the bullets for a .40 caliber weapon in his car. Well, what was his purpose for doing that? Was his purpose for bringing the gun to school to protect himself, as some have advocated teachers should do? Was it to show it off? What was his purpose and what was he thinking? And, of course, the incident, what they've talked about at First Coast, which has had a great deal of violence with guns or without guns for the last 4 or 5 years now, there are those who are arguing against having metal detectors when the kids come in the front door. Well, we have them everywhere else. Why not have them at the high school level where we're talking about young adults here? We're talking about 16, 17, 18-year-old, in many cases 19-year-olds in the 10th and 11th grade, by the way, who are there. And they're going to carry these weapons. And if we want to continue to act as if it's not happening, we're going to continue to get the same results. This is real, folks, and all the evidence and the reporting is telling us that it's real. We cannot ignore it anymore. We may have to put metal detectors at the school door to protect our kids.
And if you're just tuning in, it's our Friday Roundtable. What do you think about metal detectors in the public schools? As Fred just said, should that be on the table? After 9 guns so far this school year have been confiscated in different Duval County public schools, 549-2937. Tiffany on the south side. Hi, Tiffany. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
All right. Thanks.
Yes, my comment is I grew up here in Jacksonville, born and raised. And one, I will say that because of the times that we do live in now, I would certainly agree with, and I have 2 teenagers in my home, I would certainly agree with putting metal detectors in our public schools. One of the things that I do want to speak to is that, yes, it is a broader, we have to look at a broader picture. We have children, teenagers, that are being exposed to things in their homes, drugs, violence, that wasn't as common maybe 20 years ago as it is now. And so it has become normal for a 15-year-old boy or a 14-year-old girl to pick up a .22 and see no issue with bringing that to school. Because there are things that go on in homes, there are things that go on in neighborhoods that teachers, quite frankly, don't know anything about. And so because of the times that we live in, because we are now dealing with a very, very different generation of children, these are not the children from the 1960s. These are not the children, not even from the 80s. I was born in 78. I'm an 80s baby. And these are not even the children that I graduated with from Rains and the children I went to Northwestern. These are the children of my peers now in Jacksonville. And so we have to look at that broader picture and understand that these children now in Jacksonville are being exposed to things that I saw on television growing up in Jacksonville. And so they have access to guns. They have access to drugs. They have access to violence in a way that was just not as common when I was in high school here in Jacksonville.
All right, thanks,
and
Tiffany.
Comment to that, and
thanks for that. And certainly a lot of people agree with Tiffany. That said, crime rates are down. We do need to make that point. Even though there's a perception that crime is on the upswing, the data does not bear that out. Crime rates are a lot lower in America than they were in the 90s. But what about her comments, Claire?
You know what? I am about the same age as Tiffany, not to date myself, but and I do agree. But I grew up in a very rural community. And I was thinking when she was talking, actually, when I was in high school and middle school, we didn't have a middle school. But when I was of that age, yes, everybody knew how to use a gun. Everybody was a hunter where I grew up. And it was just an accepted part of the lifestyle. And that is another form of using weapons. Now, it's not the same, obviously, as taking a handgun to school. But I remember as young as 12 or 13, my peers would go hunting and one of them shot himself in the foot in a hunting accident. And, you know, those are different incidents, but it is still weapons. And we're looking at it differently because it's a different circumstance. But is that not a glamorization of the gun lifestyle? I'm not sure.
What about, too, the prospect of metal detectors in the Duval schools is certainly, I would think, the last thing administrators want when they're already working as hard as they can to keep parents in Duval County and not flee with their children to, say, St. John's County, where they have the idea that the schools are better and safer. Mm-hmm. Even if that's not necessarily the case, there are plenty of outstanding public schools in Duval County, David, but the optics of metal detectors and this type of thing, this is feeding into this perception that results in a lot of families leaving Duval County because they want their children in a different school system.
I think so. And also, when Fred brought it up, I see what Fred's argument is. I don't know one way or the other what the pros and cons are of it, but some questions I would have, okay, if you're going to put metal detectors in schools, do you put them in all schools or just some schools? If you put it in some schools, then basically that's an identifier that some school is more dangerous than another school. What's the cost? I mean, is that the best use of how you want to use taxpayer money to educate, taking money away from education and putting it into metal detectors? Do they work? How effective are they? There's just a ton of questions I would have, and I do think it would send a signal that would be a deterrent to parents about going to a school if they walk in and they see a metal detector.
Yeah. Lori in Nassau County. Hi, Lori. Good morning. Go ahead.
Hello. Yes. This is going back to when my daughter was in middle school. She's in college now. But when she was there, she used to come home and tell me about a teacher who said very frequently, "I'm always packing." So she, you know, she would pretty much tell her students that she was packing a weapon in her bag on a daily basis. So, you know, I think where we are, maybe a metal detector is probably not necessary because we haven't had the kind of crime that you've had up there. But you still have teachers saying things like this and adults, you know, being very casual about having weapons in the home. And this is translating to the kids, not just high schoolers, but middle schoolers.
Thanks, Lori.
You know, David raised a great point about when you decide you cross that river and you say, okay, we're going to put metal detectors in schools. Do we put them in Mandarin High School? Do we put them just in Northwest Jacksonville where, you know, the crime rate is so high? And, you know, that opens up a huge political discussion and could lead to really serious rifts in the community.
Fred.
Well, therein lies the question. Are we going to deal PC or we're going to deal in reality? PC says we worry about where we put it at. Reality says we've got a problem, and it's hitting us in the face. The students at First Coast High School and the parents over there that go to that neighborhood school for them, which they fought to get there on the north side, have been crying about the issues of violence at that school forever. Five principals have been at that school within 4.5 years trying to settle it down over there. We're past the point with them of having to argue whether they need help. We're not seeing as much at Raines High School, nor are you seeing that much at Rebo. But at First Coast, there's some issues that have popped up at Terry Parker. We can look at where they need to go And that's an issue that the school board has to seriously consider. That's why we elect them, so they can seriously consider it. And that's why we pay the superintendent more than $250,000 a year to take these things under consideration. But the evidence is there that something has to be or needs to be done. And we can play PC or we can play reality.
Let's go to Andy on the south side. Andy, go ahead.
Hey, I'm on.
Yeah, go ahead.
Hey, sorry. Yeah, I've grown up here. I'm 45 years old. I'm a lifetime NRA member. And as far as metal detectors in schools, it's not a bad idea for the students. Armed security officers or teachers with the proper training carrying, I don't think they should be advertising it. If they're concealed carrying, as far as if they have proper training, I'd be totally fine with that. I'd even be a little bit more relieved. And my time going to school here, and I grew up here at Gilbert, I had a friend of mine who had bought his dad 357 Magnum to school. I quit going to that school. When I was at Northside Skills Center, they had metal detectors and cameras. Most of the time they didn't work. I was in automotive on the downstairs level where the kids didn't have to come through them. I had a kid pull a gun out, write my name on the bullet, put it in the chamber, and dared me to answer a question in class one day. I quit going. So, yeah, that was back, I'm 45. That was back when I was 16 and, like, 14.
Jeez, Andy.
I wouldn't for a minute hesitate to put metal detectors in the school for the children, and I wouldn't hesitate for a minute to put an armed security guard or train the teachers properly to carry.
All right, that's
y'all,
Andy.
Not even
Andy,
realize.
Andy on the south side. Thank you, man. Lots of calls. John on the west side. Go ahead, John.
I don't think it's a question of putting metal detectors in the schools. I think that's a bad idea and sends a bad message. I think they need more community education and programs like other places in Florida to get guns off the streets in general, and I think that would help the most. I agree with your other callers who say things like there's differences in the different communities and there may be different needs in other places, so some communities are more violent than others. And I think you don't need a PC approach. I think you need to live in reality and you need to call it like it is and send resources to those communities. And that's the problem with Jacksonville. We live in a divided Duval County, and it's one of the most divided counties I've ever lived in Florida, where, you know, there's a definite black-white divide and there's a definite, you know, rich-poor divide. And we need to start sharing resources and putting more education and more resources out in the communities that need it.
Thank you, John. Thank you, John. And if you're just tuning in, lots of calls as we discuss all of the top stories of the week with our Friday roundtable. We're going to talk about another headline right now. It's 549-2937 to join us. And hundreds of people protested Tuesday in front of the Duval County Courthouse. Then they marched to City Hall. This protest, organized by the Jacksonville Progressive Coalition, and it was a rally against President Trump's order to temporarily ban travel from 7 Muslim-majority countries. Jacksonville has one of the highest populations of Syrian Americans in the country. One Syrian-American woman at the rally spoke with WJCT. She asked to remain anonymous because she says so many of her relatives are still in Syria, and even talking to the media could put them in danger, she said. Take a listen.
I can't imagine what they're going through. People could be targeted just for having the same last name as mine. To deprive them from freedom, to deprive them to have a better life for themselves, that stands against what America is.
Okay, so Trump's order suspends new refugee admissions for 120 days. It blocks travelers from those 7 countries for 90 days. More countries could be added to the travel ban. Syrian refugees are banned from entering indefinitely. We want your thoughts on this. It's 549-2937. The local protest, John Burr, was mirrored around the country. At the same time, a narrow majority of Americans at the last polling that was taken say they support this idea in general.
Right. And you know, whether you support the idea behind this executive order or you don't, there's little debate that the way it was executed was extremely poor and clumsy and caused a lot of disruption that really didn't need to happen. There's a lot of people who say, yeah, great idea, but boy, you know, the execution was terrible.
Claire.
Yeah, I don't even know if I think it was a great idea, because people spend roughly a year to 2 years waiting to be admitted to the United States as a refugee, and they go through an arduous process that involves many interviews and comparing their background information. It's exhaustive and it's draining. And what we're basically saying with this order is that you're not welcome in the United States based on where you were born. I take particular issue with the potential indefinite ban on Syrian refugees. These people, their country has erupted into a terrible civil war, and there are atrocities going on in that nation that are just appalling and nothing that we want to see in the free world. But it all began because they were wanting democracy in their nation. And now we're turning around and saying, you're not welcome because you might be a Muslim.
It was extraordinary when this first began, David and Fred, to see the spectacle of all of the protests at the nation's airports and attorneys rushing to the airports to try to help the detained. We're still trying to get a sense of how this is going to be proceeding, because the Trump administration has walked back some of the order. Valid green card holders are now being allowed to enter the country. That, I think that more than anything is what outraged people that understand immigration law, that if you could hold a green card and still not be allowed to come into the country.
Just the idea that one minute, you're a lawful resident of the country, and then the next minute, with a stroke of a pen, you're not. I think there, yeah, and obviously anybody who's been in an airport knows what it's like to be stuck in an airport. And just the idea of being in limbo, this international limbo. I did think it was interesting. I learned some things, like Jacksonville has the sixth largest Syrian population, eighth largest right. Iraqi population in the country. We had protests here. We have a mayor who took a position in favor of the executive order. A lot of the big elements you see on the national stage really are playing out right here in Jacksonville.
It's so true, Fred. I mean, people don't realize how large the Arab American population is in Jacksonville, one of the largest in the country, not just Syrians, but Lebanese, Palestinian. It's a really sizable part of this community.
Well, for those of us who grew up here, I mean, it's a way of life. In my old neighborhood at 20th and Fairfax, the owner of the convenience store sired two sons who happen to be the top lawyers in the city right now, and who are doing quite well. There are countless examples of that. If we go to any of the convenience stores, we have Ethiopians now who've, in many cases, have really made a killing in the convenience store business, which used to be run by Syrians and Lebanese, and many of our younger, now older, Jewish friends were in the neighborhood and made their lives here as immigrants who came to this country. But again, the reality is this. This executive order was put in place before the Attorney General was confirmed. I'm not exactly sure who the White House counsel is, but I'm sure he did not have a whole lot to say about this. And the president is not a lawyer. He's not a lawyer. He doesn't pretend to be. He doesn't act like he is one. And he's never claimed to be one. This is a campaign promise that he was going to fulfill. And the data, the polling shows that most Americans favor it. And Jacksonville voted for it. And this is the result. Elections have consequences, folks. And, you know, we may not like it.
I think you should start a podcast called that, because, you know, it's really incredible. When we talk about all these really divisive issues, Fred has made that point time and again. And it's, of course, it's true. If you don't like a certain policy, well, this is what people voted for. All right, let's go to Matt on the south side. Hi, Matt.
Hello.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to, you know, kind of say that basically I really feel like we've just kind of forgot how to step into other people's shoes. I mean, I don't, you know, I've lived in Jacksonville my entire life, and I've got Muslim friends, and I'm a very, very well practicing Christian, and I've never had any issues. And I think, you know, when it comes to taking a person and putting them in this picture of this image that I don't know, I don't want to say being sold, but it's like taking everybody and putting them in the same bucket. And I think for me, what really kind of angered me was the 5-year-old kid
that was being detained away from his mother, and it just doesn't feel good knowing that we can't have empathy when it comes to things like that.
Thanks, Matt. Thanks for that call. Stan downtown. Stan is downtown. Go ahead, Stan.
My comment is that I know that we have to be compassionate to people in these horrible environments that they're having to live in right now. But you got to consider that almost every one of these refugees coming here have to be supported by the government. And when our schools don't have enough money for our kids, we don't have the programs to teach our kids, our fund programs to help them with gun violence, things like that, as your previous topic. You know, how can we make a conscious decision to take money away from our own citizens to support others? And I know that might not be politically correct, but I'll take my answer up here.
Thank you, Stan.
Well, it might not be politically correct, but that's not statistically correct. Most of these folks are not being supported by the government, and this ban is not being put in place because they're being supported by the government. This ban is being put in place because certain people believe that these folks are a threat to this country, a terrorist threat to this country, and they're being severely vetted to make sure that that's not the case. It has nothing to do. This order has nothing to do. This is not equivalent to the Mexican issue that we have discussed about the thugs and them on welfare. This one has to do with these, seven Middle Eastern countries who we believe have the potential to bring more terrorists to this country. And again, this executive order ignores the fact that the single country that has sent more terrorists to this country was behind the 9/11 bombing. And, of course, it was the birthplace of Osama bin Laden. That country is excluded from this ban.
Saudi Arabia.
Yeah,
let me just jump in. A lot of Americans hold the perception Stan holds, which is that if refugees come here, that they don't contribute to society and that the taxpayers are supporting them. When the reality is, according to the refugee resettlement agencies in Jacksonville that we've had on this show, refugees are expected to come here, learn the language, and find a job in a very short window of time and become self-supporting very quickly.
Yeah,
so it's really a fallacy to say that we would be indefinitely supporting refugees with our tax dollars. I just wanted to make that clear.
That's true. And when we let fear guide us to prohibit people from coming to this country on the basis of where they were born or what religion they hold, we erode what it means to be America, what our values are on the world stage. And two, that actually helps recruit people to terrorist cells. And we know this. And yet we have this very clumsily executed order that caused a havoc in several airports and gave rise again to nationwide protest by a president who a lot of people take issue with his policies. And I definitely disagree that with Fred that just because we voted for someone doesn't mean people stood for every policy that they talked about on the campaign trail. We base our vote on more than one particular thing.
Let's take one more call. It's Eric who's been holding. Eric, go ahead. You're on the air.
Good morning, Melissa.
Hey.
I just wanted to point out just very quickly that we have an administration. We need to get used to it. That does not think things through. It is totally inexperienced and will be running the country like a reality show. That's going to be a sad fact of life. I also wanted to point out that I think David's numbers were a little off. I think Jacksonville has way more Arabic people here than he suggested. As a matter of fact, the top administrator for Mayor Curry happens to be of Syrian extraction. And he is
no, Sam Moose is Palestinian, Eric, but yeah, you're right. He's Arabic. Thank you for that call,
cool.
Eric. Yeah. Sam Moose basically running the day-to-day at City Hall.
That's right.
Thanks for that call, Eric. And speaking of reality shows, we live in Florida. So finally, it's our look at the strange, bizarre, and just plain ridiculous from around the state. Never a shortage of material, luckily for us. Here it is for you right now, only in Florida. And only in Florida, and maybe only in Jacksonville, does a couple videotape themselves performing a sex act inside the Duval County Courthouse. Did you hear about this?
I don't want to bring this up.
I know. Well, I'll do it for you. Police are investigating the video that has been widely shared on social media showing a man and a woman performing a sex act right in the courtroom. I won't go into any more detail, but yes, this did happen.
It was not a JSO officer, by the way.
Yeah. Speaking of video, only in Florida does a police officer get busted stealing from someone he is arresting. Now, you've heard all the hue and cry about police body cameras. Well, a Central Florida sheriff's deputy has resigned after body camera video apparently showed him taking money from a man's wallet while arresting him on suspicion of DUI. On the video, you see the deputy going through what appears to be a wallet and then tossing something out. The wallet is put in an evidence pouch and a $100 bill is visible nearby. The camera never lies.
Mm. Wow. Well. Think of all the guys taking drugs off of drug dealers. Woof.
Anyway, it's Florida, and it's now time to thank our panel. Thank you, Fred Matthews, Claire Goforth, John Burr, and David Barreline. We so appreciate you being here. Have a great weekend.
All right. Thank you, Melissa.
Thank you.
And we'll be right back.
Hendricks Avenue Baptist Church is a place to experience Christ's presence and God's Spirit in a vibrant faith community. HAB celebrates diversity, seeks to bridge differences, and journeys together in an honest and authentic search for truth. HABchurch.com. Find a different way of being Baptist.
Whiskey, Wine, and Wildlife, presented by the Westin Jekyll Island, invites you to a weekend culinary extravaganza, February 9th through 12th, benefiting the Jekyll Island Authority, featuring cooking demos, unlimited food and drink tastings, island wildlife, and music. More info at whiskeywineandwildlife.com.
WJCT's Travel and Entertainment Auction is where you'll find over 300 items, most starting at a fraction of their value at auction.wjct.org. Packages include lodging, attractions, dining, recreation, beauty, and more. The bidding begins February 9th and continues through February 20th. Log on to auction.wjct.org for more information. Bid now. The auction continues through February 20th at 8 p.m.
Great question. That is a great question.
And that's a great question. Wow, that's another great question.
That's a great question.
Oh, that's a great that's a great question.
That is a great question.
What a great question.
On Fresh Air, you'll hear unexpected questions and unexpected answers. Weekdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
Welcome back. Well, Jax Reads is underway. It's an annual initiative trying to get all of us all over the city to read, discuss, and share the same book. Barbara Gubbin heads up the Jacksonville Public Library System. She's here now with more about Jax Reads, and she even brought a copy of the book they chose. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. Thank you so much for having me on this morning.
Thank you so much for being with us. We'll do the big reveal of the book in a minute. But first, let's explain. And by the way, WJCT is a media partner for this initiative. What is the NEA Big Read and what is Jax Reads all about?
Well, Jax Reads is all about community and the community reading together the same book and then coming together maybe over a cup of coffee at work or around the dining table at home and talking about some of the issues and things that are raised by the book.
What is the book selection?
All right. Big reveal,
big
right?
Big drum roll.
The book is by an Indian-American author, Jhumpa Lahiri, and it's called The Namesake.
The Namesake. And why was this chosen?
Well, we chose this book because we felt it related to Jacksonville in a very important way, because it's the story of an family that comes from India. They're immigrants to the United States. And of course, in Jacksonville, we have a large immigrant population. And it speaks to their story here as immigrants in our country. And as the name might imply, the namesake, it speaks about the name that they give to their son. And so we all have interesting names, particularly perhaps if you come from a different country. And so that's one of the issues, discussing people's names, discussing where they might come from, their experience here in America.
Now, little did you know when you chose this book that this would be such a timely discussion, the immigrant experience in America. So this is really topical. And this is something I understand you personally really can relate to.
For sure. Well, to talk about when we chose it quite a while ago. It is part of a grant program from the National Endowment of the Arts and Arts Midwest. So I should say thank you to them, because we're one of 77 nonprofit organizations that got a grant to support Jax Reads. And yes, you're right. So I'm very proud also to be an immigrant to America. I've lived here many, many years. But I think it's important to recognize our heritage and find an opportunity for different people to talk about their experience.
What has it been like for you? I mean, obviously you've lived in the States for a long time, but is coming to this country just a unique experience that there's no way a native-born person could really understand what it's like in the way that immigrants experience coming here from another culture, another land? This is something that I can tell it's personal for you.
For sure. I mean, I remember when I first came here, and it's 40 years ago this year that I came to San Antonio, Texas, and started working at the public library, and realizing whilst we spoke the same language, English, maybe we didn't quite understand each other sometimes, how we pronounce words. I had some sort of interesting misunderstandings across that reference desk when I first started. But I think it makes you think and listen perhaps a little harder and try and understand somebody else's culture, and then feel inclined to share the culture you have, because that's more for everybody.
So the namesake is the Jax Reads Choice for the big campaign that kicked off the beginning of February. This is something you want everybody to do. Anyone that's interested in reading, how can people be part of Jax Reads this month? And this goes all the way through March 11th. And just reading the book is a big part of it, but that's not all you're doing, right?
Absolutely not. So let me tell you, first of all, tomorrow, Saturday, we have a wonderful program downtown at the main library. It's called From Home to Abroad. And we have people from Germany, from Haiti, from Ireland coming and talking about their immigrant experience. It starts at 3 o'clock at the main library tomorrow, Saturday, February 4th. And then you can go to jaxpubliclibrary.org and find our whole list of programs. There are book discussions. There's the film of the namesake that we're sharing. There's commentary about names. We've got dance groups. So a lot of things going on. And then on March the 11th, Saturday, March the 11th, again at the main library at 1 o'clock, we have Indian-American film director Meera Nair, who directed the film The Namesake, coming to the library.
Oh, she's globally renowned.
She
so
is
that's
globally
very exciting.
Renowned. Yes, yeah. Indeed.
So people need to go to the Jacksonville Public Library's website, mark your calendars for everything involving Jax Reads, and pick up a copy of The Namesake. Be part of a citywide reading project. Go to jpl.net for more information. Barbara Gubbin, always good to see you. Thanks for spreading the word.
Thank you, Melissa. And everybody, go out and find the namesake and enjoy a great read this month. Thank you.
Back in a moment.
It's no longer just science fiction. For the first time, scientists have grown human stem cells in a pig embryo. I'm Ira Flatow. On the next Science Friday, we'll talk about this groundbreaking work that might lead to growing human replacement body parts in animals. Plus, how to hunt for life when you don't even know what the life might look like. The challenges of astrobiology on Science Friday from PRI.
Fridays at 2 on 89.9 WJCT.
We play all your favorite oldies every Monday night at 10. Join us for Route 66. Tune in, flashback, 89.9 WJCT-FM, Monday nights at 10.
Welcome back. Well, February is National Heart Disease Awareness Month, and one way to raise that awareness is Go Red for Women. It's the American Heart Association's national movement to end heart disease and stroke in women. Cardiovascular disease kills one woman in this country every 80 seconds. But the good news is most of these events can be prevented with education and lifestyle changes. Dr. Amy Pollack of Mayo Clinic is the Go Red chairwoman for Jacksonville, and she's wearing a beautiful red suit. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having us.
Also here, heart disease survivor Kathy Ellis. Good to see you.
Thank you.
We'll hear Kathy's story in a moment, but first, Dr. Pollack, it's Go Red for Women Day. You'll see a lot of women dressed in red. Tell us about Go Red for Women.
Well, just as you said, it's a national movement to raise awareness about the risks of heart disease in women and what we can do to help hopefully prevent heart attacks and stroke.
Risk factors, understanding our risk factors, and knowing the five numbers that can change your life.
Exactly. So knowing what your blood pressure is. It's called the silent killer because you oftentimes won't know if your blood pressure is too high. So it's so important to have your blood pressure checked regularly, particularly if you have high blood pressure. And even if you think your blood pressure is fine, get it checked to make sure that it really is.
Yeah, your blood pressure, your total cholesterol, your blood sugar, your body mass index, all of these numbers women need to know. Kathy Ellis, you're a heart disease survivor. Can you tell us about your story through heart disease, your journey?
It all started December 21st, a typical day at work. I was getting ready to go home, finish up for the day, and had some indigestion that progressed to back pain and then progressed to some aching in my elbows, in the inner part of my arm.
And you did not realize at first you were having a heart attack?
No.
At what point did they start treating you for a cardiovascular event?
One of our transplant doctors came in, looked at vital signs, did an AccuCheck, and then once I started just profusely sweating, you know, I thought, and I couldn't even raise my arms. I couldn't get out of the chair.
Wow.
I was just exhausted.
Did you have any risk factors that would have led doctors to think you were at risk of a heart attack?
Well, I've got some mild diabetes, high blood pressure, menopause. I was a little bit overweight. I wouldn't say obese, but I was a little overweight.
But I bet you never thought this could happen to you, right? Most women don't think about it.
I don't know.
You did?
I have a strong family history.
Oh, okay. So that's another risk factor. Right. Okay. So Dr. Pollack, how typical is Kathy's story? Because women, the number one killer of women is heart disease, but women are culturally conditioned to think a lot more about breast cancer than heart disease.
So you're right. Oftentimes women will present with symptoms other than chest pain. So when women are coming in with an actual heart attack, only 60% of the time will women complain of chest pain or pressure, which means 40% of women with a heart attack are not going to have chest pain or pressure. It'll be other symptoms like indigestion unrelated to what you've eaten, shortness of breath, breaking out into a cold sweat. Sometimes it's just a vague sense that something is not right, or neck or shoulder jaw pain.
Wow. All symptoms that women should take very seriously.
Absolutely.
Now, so again, you need to understand your risk factors. As Kathy said, if there's a family history, quitting smoking, eating a healthier diet, getting your cholesterol down, all of those are so important. But the five numbers that can change your life as we talk about Go Red for Women Day: your total cholesterol, know that number, your HDL or good cholesterol, your blood pressure, your blood sugar, and your body mass index, or BMI. Women, when they go for a checkup, how important is it that they talk to their doctors about all of that?
So each time you're going in for your well woman checkup or your annual physical, you need to be looking at those five risk factors and talking with your doctor about them. And as Kathy pointed out, if you have a family history of heart disease or stroke, it's so important to share that information with your doctor, because sometimes it changes how aggressive we are in looking at lower levels of cholesterol or potentially even lower levels of blood pressure.
And often, you know, Kathy, the well woman check is the only opportunity most women have to get this type of screening done. And increasingly, gynecologists are sending their patients out for this type of heart tests and screening. So now, after having gotten through this, have you made any changes, lifestyle changes?
Well, I make it a point to exercise more. I try and eliminate my stress. I don't let things bother me like I used to. I just kind of say I have to let it go. My blood pressure is normal. You know, it's being treated. My numbers are good. I've lost weight. So
that's all good news. Mm-hmm. Well, again, it's Go Red for Women Day, because February is National Heart Disease Awareness Month. Know those five numbers, ladies. They can change your life. Don't discount this. It is something every woman needs to know. And we thank you so much for coming in your beautiful red, both of you, to share this. Dr. Amy Pollack, Mayo Clinic. She's the Go Red chairwoman in Jacksonville. And Kathy Ellis, a heart disease survivor. Thanks for being here.
Thanks
You're
so
welcome.
Much.
Thank you.
We'll be right back.
Hi, this is Chris Thiele inviting you to join us this weekend for a live broadcast of A Prairie Home Companion from Nashville's historic Ryman Auditorium. Our guests include Amos Lee, Jenny Lewis, and comedian Nate Bargatze, plus the Royal Academy of Radio Actors, Tim Russell, Serena Brooke, and sound effects man Fred Newman, also my Song of the Week, with our first call radio players and more, all right here.
Saturday evenings at 6 on 89.9 WJCT.
Unlock your newest member benefit. Over 1,000 episodes of your favorite PBS shows. American Masters. Antiques Roadshow. Nature. Nova. Masterpiece. Watch the best of PBS anytime, anywhere. Become a member. Sign in and start streaming today.
WJCT.org/passport.
Welcome back. Finally this hour, the North Florida Pumas are making their debut in Jacksonville. Tryouts are set for tomorrow for this region's new all-female football team. Head coach Kim Brown is here. Good morning.
Good morning. How you doing?
Great. Thanks for coming. So good to see you.
Thank you for
having
us.
Is this a first for Jacksonville?
No, it's not a first. It's a first for us. We're starting this new team, the North Florida Pumas. Jacksonville has two teams now. This is our first year, and we're just looking to build a team so that we can have the women can have more opportunity to play ball.
Okay, so tell us about this team in this league. This is women's tackle football.
Yes, ma'am.
Yeah. So full body contact, and you're having tryouts tomorrow. Over on Normandy Boulevard at the Normandy Athletic Association. Well, more about that in a moment. What do women know as they hear about this and they think, I might want to try out?
What they know about football, most of them don't know much. They know what they see on TV.
That's right.
So we're teaching them from the beginning, which actually makes it a little bit easier, I think, from a standpoint of if you get guys coming up, they've had a lot of different coaches, a lot of different philosophies. When you get the ladies come in, they don't really know how to play the game. You get to teach them from the ground up. So you get to be the first to introduce them, and it's just a lot easier to handle it that way.
And what league are the Pumas going to be a part of?
It's the WFA Women's Football Alliance.
And how much has that grown over the years?
A lot. This year, I think right now we're at about 68 teams in the league. So the
demand is
growing. Tremendous. Yes.
What would you say to those listening, in particular male football fans who might be condescending or, you know, try to put down what you're doing?
You know, give it a shot. If you like football, come out and watch, because it's football. It's women playing. It's still the same game. So if you just give it a chance, you come out, and I've not met somebody that came out and said they didn't like it. So if you're a football fan, then we provide that venue for you during the spring when there's not a lot of football around.
So, where are the Pumas going to play?
Right now we're working on that. We haven't nailed down the stadium yet. So that's probably one of the hardest things to do for an organization is to nail down a place to call home. So we're working on it.
Okay. But in the meantime, you want to get the word out about the tryouts. This is open to any woman 18 or older who would like to play during the 2017 season. Tryouts are coming up tomorrow.
Yes, ma'am. We've had some tryouts, but tomorrow we're trying to have a final open tryout where anybody can come out that's interested, and we'll take a look at you and hopefully be able to get some good athletes out there to help us build our team.
Okay, so tryout tomorrow if this interests you. Tryouts from 10 a.m. to 12 for the North Florida Pumas. This is going to be women's tackle football in Jacksonville. Go on out to the Normandy Athletic Association practice field. That is at 10727 Normandy Boulevard. Head coach Kim Brown, just in time for the Super Bowl, we're going to have women's football in Jacksonville. Good luck, and thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having us. We really appreciate it.
And go to nfpumas.com for more. Well, that's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Kevin Mershart. Michelle Corum runs the board. The show theme is composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony Orchestra's Pyotr Chevchik. Never miss a show. Grab our podcast just by downloading the WJCT app and listen to all of our shows through the app. Up next on 1A, the weekly news roundup. I'm Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT FM Jacksonville. Your community, your world. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. Monday. Have a great weekend.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.